Welcome to the Jerusalem Post podcast. I'm Yaakov Katz and joined, as always, by Lahav Harkov. Lahav, Chag Sameach. How's your Sukkot going?
Sukkot is going great. It's supposed to be the happiest week of the year, you know.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know if it's actually the happiest week of the year, but
Zman Simchatenu.
It's a good, right, Zman Simchatenu, exactly. It's a fun holiday. Fun spending time with family.
As am I, and in line with the fun and the joy, we have a special guest this week.
Yeah.
Your idea, so you deserve the credit for pulling this off. You want to tell our listeners who they will hear from later?
Yeah, I brought comedian Modi, who some of you may have heard of. He's been a successful stand-up comedian for like 25 years now. Also born in Israel, but grew up in the States and is Jewish and tells a lot of really good, funny jokes about Jewish topics, religious
Jewish life, Jewish ritual, like Jewish tradition.
Yeah, throws in a lot of Yiddish.
A lot of Yiddish.
You'll hear more about it, but he actually started his career in the Catskills in the late 90s, which I didn't think was a thing that happened in the late 90s still, and yet he did it.
Well, stay tuned and listen as we move forward, because it's a great show and a great interview, and Modi really tells us not only about his career, but also how he got into this, and shares some jokes with us, talks about his relationship with Israel, Judaism, how he learned Yiddish, which I found to be very interesting, that story.
Yeah.
So there's a lot coming up. But before we get to the Simcha, Lahav, this country is crazy. Can I just say that?
Yeah.
Because what's going on with this deal with Lebanon is just, it, to me, it's like a bit nuts and being blown out of proportion to an extent, right? And just so our listeners know,
in both directions, by the way,
of course, without a doubt, in both directions, Israel and Lebanon, with American mediation, have reached an agreement to set what would be called some sort of maritime border, basically would allow the Lebanese to take over waters that are in economic waters, and apparently, and build a gas rig there, which they can then extract gas from. Israel already has one on the other side, on the Israeli side. And hopefully this will end a standoff and tension with Hezbollah, which had already tried to attack the Israeli gas rig called Karish and was threatening a war potentially. And Israel was also in war footing, and on and on and on and on and on. And Lapid is celebrating this historic agreement. And Netanyahu was saying, if I'm elected, I will overturn this shameful surrender and concession to Hezbollah. So Lahav, who's right?
Okay. I let you describe the whole thing without interruption, because like there's I could give notes on almost every sentence, right? Like it's so I feel like I could write a PhD on this right now. You described it as Netanyahu's calling it a surrender to Hezbollah. Lapid is celebrating a historic agreement. And the truth, I think, is somewhere in the middle. I think the agreement is a lot less historic than people are making it out to be, in the sense that, yes, it's an agreement with Lebanon, which is an enemy state, but it remains an enemy state. They don't recognize Israel. They don't recognize our borders. The agreement, in fact, you know, I say there's an agreement between Israel and Lebanon as a shorthand, but in fact, it's Lebanon has an agreement with the U.S. and Israel has an agreement with the U.S. It's not with each other. Because of Lebanon, Israel's willing to negotiate with Lebanon. You know, this isn't like, this isn't a peace agreement. This isn't an actual step towards normalization. And frankly, yes, Lebanon itself is an enemy state, but who do we fight with in Lebanon? We fight with Hezbollah, and this isn't, you know, helping us on that front at all. On the other hand, when you talk about surrendering to Hezbollah, look, I think, and I've written about this, I think that the timing of the agreement, which is to say that it really was rushed in the past few months, like, the talks were sort of very slowly moseying along and maybe not even going anywhere until Hezbollah flew drones over Israel's Karish reservoir on the first day, on Lapid's first day of prime minister. And then Lapid went into sort of overdrive with it and prioritized it a lot. And I think it's because he didn't want a war with Hezbollah in his hands. Now, nobody wants a war with Hezbollah, right? Like, I don't blame him. But I think that the biggest benefit of this deal, frankly, is that it, at least for now, is quieting Hezbollah down. as opposed to the actual details of the deal.
Right, but hold on. But Lahav, even without getting into, because there's a lot of questions here that remain open.
Well, I haven't said what's actually in the deal yet either. So
right. But even without getting into, you know, what exactly are the waters? What exactly are the borders? What exactly are the perimeters? What's this line, that line, and the other line? Okay. But on a geopolitical strategic level, having Lebanon establish a gas rig and have energy independence will cut off the dependency on Iran, which has been supplying fuel to Lebanon, which only has a few hours a day of electricity because of the huge economic crisis they have there. Hezbollah has been able to take credit for that and says, you know, we are the patron of Lebanon because we're the ones who are providing the fuel from Iran. It also is creating a more stable Lebanon, which isn't definitely in Israeli interest, right? So from a security perspective, this is a good deal.
I agree that a more stable Lebanon would be good for Israel. The thing is that I think people are making a false distinction between Lebanon and Hezbollah right now. I mean, I'm not saying every citizen of Lebanon is a terrorist, of course not, but Hezbollah has a chokehold on this government. It controls a lot of the banking in Lebanon, which is part of why, you know, the economy is a basket case there. It's also because there's sanctions on Hezbollah and U.S. sanctions, at least. And so, you know, even if in theory there's guarantees in this deal that because of U.S. sanctions and et cetera, the money from gas in the disputed area will not go to Hezbollah, I think it's very hard to separate anything going to the government of Lebanon from Hezbollah at this point. And it's, I mean, look, Hezbollah is celebrating. That's fine. They need to save face. I think they would have celebrated no matter, you know, even if this deal was, you know, even better for Israel. But in terms of, you know, when the senior U.S. officials and senior Israeli officials who are briefing journalists say, like, oh, we're not negotiating with Hezbollah, this has nothing to do with Hezbollah, like, frankly, some of the government officials who are the chief negotiator of the deal, this guy Elias Bou, I'm sure I'm going to mispronounce his name, but the chief negotiator in Lebanon.
The Lebanese one, yeah.
Yeah, is a Hezbollah supporter, right? He's pro-Hezbollah, and he's documented saying lots of pro-Hezbollah things. So it's just, it's a game, and maybe we have to play that game, just like we let Qatar send money to Hamas, you know, like, and it was not a permanent solution, but it was a temporary solution. But, you know, let's not pretend that we're not playing that game.
That I'll accept. But also there's now this whole thing going on, definitely on social media and elsewhere, of the guarantee that Israel is getting from the United States, right? Which is as if U.S. guarantees are meaningless now to Israel. And I get that there's, you know, going to be the Republican pushback against, because obviously this is a Democrat and the Biden administration. But we are, after all, still talking about the United States that gives Israel $3.8 billion annually in military aid, that sells Israel the most sophisticated aircraft and missiles and military platform, shares the most classified and sensitive intelligence with Israel. Suddenly, all of that, like, we can't trust the Americans? Guarantees mean nothing?
No, I don't think it's that we can't trust the Americans. But I do think when you look at it realistically, the guarantee is only worth as much as America wants to throw its weight around on any given day.
And that's with everything, though, right?
Right. 100%. Right. That's what, okay, I'm saying. So realistically, like, that's, but no, I think that the American guarantee, I think the fact that this is mediated by the U.S., which is something that Lebanon accepts the U.S. as a mediator, that's a positive thing. I mean, there's certain people, Netanyahu being among them, who are not going to concede anything good about this deal, because it's an election and that's just how it is.
So then that's the issue.
Right, but I think that there are real criticisms of the deal that are being drowned out because they're just like, oh, well, Netanyahu is one to talk. He capitulated to terrorism on this and this and this. And I just think, like, fine, we can have that argument, but let's talk about this deal.
But this is hard to do, Lahav. And I think this is...
It's very hard, I've noticed.
It's hard to do because it's a complicated deal, right? And which line and which water and where it goes and who does it belong to and where does the water come from? That's one part that makes it complicated. But the other part
Wait, can we put a pin in that? I feel like, yeah, we didn't really tell anyone what the deal does. So maybe I should just say that quickly.
Tell people what the deal is.
Okay, so there's like a triangle, almost, it's like a pizza slice almost, of the Mediterranean Sea, starting about 12 miles out from the land border between Lebanon and Israel from the shore. And that triangle has been in dispute since 2011. There were a bunch of attempts over a decade to settle that dispute. Now it's been settled. Essentially, Israel is letting that entire triangle be Lebanon's economic waters. Had it been Israel's economic waters, it would have been less than 2% of Israel's waters. So it's not a lot of water. But Israel's letting that be Lebanon's economic waters in exchange for royalties from a gas field that basically extends across from Lebanese waters across the disputed area into Israel. So Israel's going to get royalties from that area. And also a sort of recognition of what's called the buoys line, buoy meaning like, you know, floaty things. Israel has a 5 kilometer or roughly 6 mile line of buoys extending from the land at the border into the sea. That's supposed to be a physical obstacle for Israel's security. And that the word buoy line, those two words are written in the deal as they are part of the status quo between Israel and Lebanon. Status quo, not a border, because as I said, this is not normalization. Lebanon's not recognizing the border. But to the Israeli Navy, it was important to get that in there. So those are the two things Israel's getting officially. Unofficially, hopefully, some quiet from Hezbollah for some time.
Oh, and royalties potentially from the gas.
I said the royalties. Right. Yeah.
So with the deal in place, right, I think the question really comes down to one of politics. And as you mentioned before, that was going to be the second part of what I was going to say, is that if this had not been coming down 2-3 weeks before an election, would people really be caring at all about this? I mean, it, you know, a little water that's transferring from maybe to Lebanon, which might not have even been ours to begin with, does that really make a difference to anybody? And I think that the elections is what's tainting this whole thing.
Yes, I agree. And I'll add to that, that the royalties that we get, the estimate right now is that entire gas field has $3 billion worth of gas. And Israel will end up getting less than $1 billion out of this. So, I mean, I'd love $1 billion and everything, but for a country that's, you know, an economically successful country like Israel, $1 billion is not such a huge thing.
And also the amount of gas that we have
we have way more gas than
correct.
That. So it's more symbolic than the actual, like, what anybody's getting or losing in this deal, for sure. Listen, this deal is coming down to the wire right before the election. I mean, we're speaking on Wednesday while the Security Cabinet is discussing and will vote on this. It's expected to be approved with maybe one person opposed to it. So, you know, it's going to pass, and then it's going to be, the procedure is that it has to be put in the Knesset table. That's what they call it. It's submitted to the Knesset for 2 weeks of review. And then after those 2 weeks is the final authorization. And that brings us down to Election Day.
Right. Pretty much.
And so that's part of people's problem with it. And I think that that's a really reasonable opposition to it, that, you know, you can't make international deals that will, you know, require the next government to follow through on them literally on Election Day. So that I think also is an issue. And I understand the timing argument, in because if the government would admit that they were doing this to get Hezbollah off of our backs, then the timing makes a lot of sense. They, of course, know that that's not a winning message, so they're not saying it.
You know what we can thank everyone for, though, with regards to this deal, is all these new terms that everybody in Israel now is familiar with, from the continental shelf to the EEZ, right, the exclusive economic zones, to the buoy line, right? You have a ton of Israelis now who are walking around as maritime law experts and have been reading Geneva Conventions. And of course, there are real experts, but it's also interesting, among those real experts, people have been published on these topics. There's clear disagreements. I mean, I was reading one article by one international law expert who said this is not there is no sovereignty over these waters. Another one who claims there is. Another one from Tel Aviv University who says the continental shelf is not sovereign. I mean, it goes on and on and on, the different interpretations. And what we know for now is that the Supreme Court, there have been petitions to the Supreme Court. So far, the Supreme Court has said we're not wading into this mess at the moment. So it'll be interesting to see how that progresses. But while this is happening, Lahav, you mentioned, you know, the elections and how that's kind of overcasting the shadow over everything. But there's also violence, which is closer to home.
Well, closer to our homes. People live in, you know, Nahariya.
That's true. Closer to our homes, at least. Well, inside Israeli borders, not in the waters that are outside. Two soldiers were killed. One, Noah Lazar, was killed while on duty at the Shuafat checkpoint in East Jerusalem late Saturday night. And Ido Baruch from Sayeret Givati was killed just yesterday on Tuesday when there was a drive-by shooting not far from Shavei Shomron, Israeli community in the northern West Bank. And it's not getting any better there, it seems, right? The violence is continuing. No one has a good solution as of yet. There's threats that Israel will launch some sort of large-scale operation. Maybe the Palestinians will crack down more. There's this relatively new terrorist group, Lion's Den, of the Palestinians that they're arguing what they're supposed to do with them.
Very young, the Lion's Den people. It's like 20-year-olds, and they're not officially affiliated with any of the bigger terrorist groups. They just plan their own kind of things like this, drive-by shootings that are it's a lot harder to get intelligence and prevent them that way.
Right. And attacks that are not as organized as others. Lapid is trying to talk tough. So is Benny Gantz. Lots of visits to Judea and Samaria by the defense minister lately, but it doesn't seem to be bringing a drop in terror, and this is also casting a big shadow, I would say, over the election.
Yeah, I mean, it definitely is, but I feel like it would have been bigger normally. Like, there's something, I think people are just like sort of so apathetic with all of the elections that maybe it's made a lot of people more apathetic even to this, because I think normally I think Bibi would have been able to really play this to his advantage, and also, you know, as the opposition leader right now while the terrorism is happening. And I just think that there would have been a big uproar. And I don't know if it's because it's the holidays and people are on vacation or if it's just election fatigue. But I do feel like people who don't, like, unless, you know, I know people who are settlers. And I also, you know, when I'm reading all different kinds of media, I'm reading right-wing media and they're making a big deal about it. But otherwise, the like mainstream, the more popular channels, the more popular news programs, it's like, I don't know. It doesn't feel like it's as big a deal as it almost should be.
I mean, it definitely should be a huge deal. But it's also, I just think people are definitely sick and tired of the elections. On the train this morning, I heard someone who was busy on the phone yelling at his wife, I think it was, maybe girlfriend, I don't know, trying to say, book the ticket. Basically, they're booking tickets for Greece tomorrow. Like, that's what's on people's minds, right? Is how do I get the cheap deal on Israel or Kia to be able to get to Greece tomorrow for the long weekend, as opposed to what party am I going to vote for? And people just don't care. And unfortunately, you know, that leads also, it kind of connects with the apathy, but also to just, I think, some sort of like manipulation of news to an extent, and blowing maybe this story of Lebanon up into a degree of where maybe it shouldn't be, because there's an election going on and it's just a good opportunity for everyone to take a swing at one another. I don't know, but it's definitely not a good situation. And even if we're already talking about the elections,
I mean, also maybe just because this wave of violence has been going on for a very long time.
And when we talk about the elections, Lahav, still no. We had a poll last week showing that Bibi actually got to 61, just barely. But then there were polls that came out since then that showed that Bibi's back down to 59 or 60 with his potential coalition. So it's really close. I mean, we're just a few weeks
religious
out.
Religious Zionism is eating away at Likud also, which is interesting. Likud's numbers are
very,
going down each
very
time.
Strong. Very strong and a lot very popular. It's impossible to predict what will happen. But I mean, I would say, you know, the best prediction, actually, if we want to give one, in my view, is this is the fifth election, so we can go to a sixth election.
Yeah, unfortunately.
Unfortunately.
It's, like, very sad, but true.
But on that sad but true note, possibly, we have a great interview with Modi. Thank you, Laha, yes, for arranging that for us. It was fantastic to talk to him. And as you'll tell in the beginning, he makes fun of me because I just don't know how to say things right. So so here we go. Here's Modi, the great comedian. Lots of fun. Enjoy. Chag Sameach. You might know him by his name, Modi Rosenfeld. You might know him
now,
by...
No, Modi, when did Rosenfeld come into... I have branded myself for the past 25 years as just Modi, and lately everybody's been introducing me as Modi Rosenfeld. Mm-hmm. It's Modi. You know him as Modi.
Just Modi. Name
like, is, like the Prime Minister of India.
Exactly.
Uh-huh. Okay, so you know him as Modi. You might know him as Nir, right? He's one of the characters. Uh-huh. You might know him as Yoeli, who was running for president, right, at one point.
Okay, that was probably the worst pronunciation of Yoeli.
Yoeli. Okay.
That was the most like a non-Hasidic pronunciation of Yoeli, but okay, yeah.
We're the pleased to have Modi, not known as Rosenfeld, on the Jerusalem Post podcast. Thank you for joining us.
So happy to be here. You guys are great. Thank you so much for having me. You're in Israel, right? You guys are in Israel?
We are in Israel.
You're in Israel, right. So happy post-Chag Sukkot.
Mm-hmm. Chag Sameach.
Yep. This will be coming out during Chol HaMoed.
Great.
You have told some good jokes lately about how people wish a happy holiday to each other.
Oh, the Chag Sameach bit. Yeah. Chag Sameach, Yud Yontif. People love that. It's so funny. It hit like the Orthodox community, the non-religious community. Everybody was into that bit. Yeah.
Well, it's funny to me as in Israel, I feel like jokes about like Ashkenazim do this and Sephardim say this like have been around, but this is the first time I heard someone telling jokes like that in English, like in a stand-up comedian routine. And have you been telling jokes like that for a long time? Like, was there ever like a worry like would that go over?
No, it's probably like 2 years I have this. It's a part of a big, big bit. It's a part of a whole bit. You're probably seeing just like clips now. The attention span people have is that of a crack baby. So we have to put out like under 59 seconds of material. So what you're seeing, that Chag Sameach and Yud Yontif and Shabbat Shalom and Shabbos, is all a part of a really big bit, which has a whole bunch of things in it. And that's kind of been like building up for about, I would say, 2 years. It starts off with Hamotzi, and then how Sephardic and Ashkenazi treat their rabbis, and then how they the reading of the Torah in the synagogue. And then it even goes to Aliyot. It goes to Yishar Koach and Chazak Baruch. It's very long. I just took two bits and put them out there. And it's, they were good choices because it's, I guess, bits everybody gets.
Modi.
Yeah.
You're a comedian. You become very popular. You have a big following, on social media, but also shows. You're appearing all over the place. How do the non-Jews take to all of this? Like, well, you know, because it's very Jewish.
They love it. I sometimes screenshot and put the DMs I get, the direct messages on Instagram. They love it because every person who's not Jewish has a Jew in their life.
Or the Goyim, as you call them in the show.
I call them Goyim. I've stopped with this Gentile and non-Jew stuff. I call them Goyim, and I explain it in my show why Goy and Goyim is not a bad word. It's just how you use it. It's the same as the word Jew. It's just how you use the word. And they love it because they know that they're Goyim. They know we call them Goyim. And they love it, and it more brings them in America. It's funny. I just did two shows in Israel where there were no goyim at all in the audience, so it was funny. I didn't have to explain stuff, but in America, when I do, it's a part of the show explaining to them what this means, and like taking a beat and making a face like, okay, wait a minute, everybody, I got to explain it to those two people in the corner. And so they love it. They love it. Obviously, when I'm doing a room of like Haredi Jews or Hasidic Jews, it's much more specific material, mm-hmm. which makes it so much more personalized to them. And that's why they connect to my material so much more. But when I'm at the Comedy Cellar, or when I'm doing an event where it's a, let's say some kind of like an organization that brings me in that has half of it is like, there's 500 people and 250 are Jewish and 200 are not. And then you have all, you know, and they get it. And I mean, the theme of my show currently, the one that I'm about to tape is called Know Your Audience. And it's not just the Jews. You have to also know the non-Jews in the room and be able to work for them also.
So it sounds like you don't have like separate shows for, say, when you're in the Comedy Cellar, right, famous New York venue, and when you're performing to like a Hasidish audience. People appreciate more or less the same jokes, except I assume you go cleaner for the Hasidish audience.
First of all, I'm usually always clean. It's very rare that that a curse word comes out of me. And when I do obviously, when I can do a Hasidic room or a more religious room, I can throw a little more Yiddish around. I can do a little more Hebrew, a little more specific to something like davening. I would never do the Ashkenazi Sephardic bit at the Comedy Cellar because they don't get, it's too specific.
Too inside baseball.
It's too inside, yeah. But I'll compare Jewish shows to shows with that are like, you know, like swamp people and things of that sort. But it's when you hit the stage and you look out, you can feel what the room needs and you have an arsenal of material and you use what you think is going to work.
So you have an interesting story. And I think I'm curious if this, your own personal background kind of ties into this interesting range that you have of characters and just knowledge. You know, you were born in Israel, you moved to the US, Woodmere, I think five towns, right? Back in,
yeah.
When you were just about seven or so, born to Israeli parents. So you have the Israeli background. That's where the Hebrew comes from.
I'm Israeli. I was born in Israel. We came here when I was 7 years old.
You speak Hebrew like an Israeli. You speak English like an American. Growing up in Woodmere, I'm guess gave you insight into that modern Orthodox Jewish community. But like, where does the Hasidish, Yeshivish, Yiddish stuff come? Yoyli, where does he come from?
So let's just back up on what your answer to that question. So you say this is where you had an opportunity for a joke. You were born in Israel, so you speak Hebrew like an Israeli. You lived in America, so you speak English like an American. And you lived in the five towns, so you speak like you're entitled. That's where you could have had your joke.
Got it. Okay.
All right. Where does the Yiddish come from? Okay.
I mean, where does it all come from? Like, where does it all come from? Range?
Okay. Yeah. No problem. So it's like this. We grew up in a house. There was absolutely no English in the house. My parents never spoke English in the house. My parents, when they came to America, all their friends were Israeli. So we, in the house, there was always, and my aunts and uncles were here, and it was just Hebrews in the house. That was that. We had grandparents with the Yiddish in the background, and I focused on it. My sisters didn't, but my ear was like, I'm like, this is good. Whatever they're doing is good. So I would sit and speak with them. And then I became like more religious than my parents, and I loved yeshiva. And I went to I went to BU, Boston University, and there was a yeshiva next door. It was a Chabad yeshiva where a Lubavitch yeshiva where the young kids were going. Like it was like a university for kids going to become rabbis, and I would go there almost as much as I was at BU. And one of my favorite things was to study the Lubavitch Rebbe's sichas, the speeches that he wrote. And I would study them only in Yiddish.
Wow.
So that was my favorite thing, more than Gemara, more than Torah, more than anything, was to study the sichas. And so that's where I picked up a lot of the Yiddish. And then working in the communities and working with people who are Hasidic, they're just amazing. They're just... they always get the worst rap. And, you know, during the pandemic, it's like 2 years back now, we're talking, you know, when the pandemic began, I was living in New York, and the Hasidic community got the worst rap in the world. They were just, they couldn't quarantine. They had 12 people living in the house, in a three-bedroom apartment. It was just horrible. And then all that, that movie, Unorthodox came out, and then the one where whatever, horrible things. Just so I went on as this cute character named Yoeli, and everybody loved it. And then there was the election, so I ran as president as Yoeli, and I had a great time with it. And once in a while, I do cameos with it. That's like a video people hire me to do for them. And but I kind of like left it alone since the pandemic, because I've been, now I'm doing stand up. I'm out. I'm working. You know,
right.
I'm not at home.
But before comedy, you were an investment banker, right?
I worked at an investment bank at Merrill Lynch. And then I was imitating the secretaries. And they and my friends said to me, you should do this on stage. And I began doing comedy in 1994. A little bit before, actually. But I got passed as a comedian at the Comedy Cellar in 1994, which is when I mark my beginning of comedy. And I was doing two jobs. It was both full-time comedy and full-time at the bank. I was like the only comic in a suit at the late night shows. And in 1999, I think, is when I left the bank to go work full-time as a comedian.
Wow. And so you've been basically a working comedian ever since, which is impressive. It's a very demanding career.
I'm very, very blessed. Besides the regular comedy circuit of the clubs and the comedy clubs all over, and I had the tail end of the Catskills too, which really shaped my comedy. You know, there were a few hotels left, like three or four hotels left, and they had a show Fridays and Saturday nights, and I would be booked up for those shows. And you know, you go from doing a 10-minute spot in the city, which is how comics begin. You're in the city doing 10 minutes, 15-minute spots. All of a sudden, a band brings you on, and you're doing an hour in a tuxedo. It was surreal.
Pretty amazing. Almost. Like a time machine.
Exactly. I drove into a time warp. Mm-hmm. I would head north out of the city and drive into a time warp and just land on those stages. And they were still going like I was the last weekend of the Concord Hotel.
Oh, wow.
I opened for, I don't know if you ever heard of these two singers called the Barry Sisters.
Yeah.
One of them was still alive, Claire Barry, and I was her opening act that weekend. And that was the last weekend of the Concord Hotel. And then there was still the Raleigh Hotel, and there was still the Neville, and I think one Cutters or two
was
others.
Still around back then. I think I've spent a couple weekends there.
Yeah, it was a time where it's exactly what you said. I drove north into a time machine.
Wow.
You said you had recently been to Israel. You did these two shows, I think, with the United Hatzalah, right? Yehud Hatzalah.
Yes.
Coming to Israel and, you know, being Israeli, what's your take of the Israeli comedian or comedy market?
To be honest with you, I don't watch Israeli comedians. Mm-hmm. I don't watch their... I know there's a bunch of names that were thrown at me. And I recently produced and co-hosted the Chosen Comedy Festival. It was an amazing event. Me, Ilan Gold, hosted it. And Donnie Zolden of Stand Up in New York, we produced this event called the Chosen Comedy Festival. And it was 4,000 people at the amphitheater in Coney Island. And we had two Israeli comedians on.
Okay.
I know Israeli comedians have that the fact that everybody in their country knows who's in parliament and who's left and who's right, where in America we barely know who the president or the vice president is.
Right. So that opens for more political jokes and comedy. You're able to do less of that.
Obviously, in Israel, they've all been to the army, so they all know what happens when you join the army, and so they can do all of that laughter. They know they're living in one small little state, so they know which highway has always traffic jams, and it's like a they have so much more in common with each other. You know, where over here, I'm sitting in an audience where everybody's from all over America. I can't do a joke about the Belt Parkway. Where right. over there, the Ayalon, I get a ticket on the Ayalon because I got the cameras or whatever their materials. It's much more specific.
Sounds easier, honestly.
I don't think it's easier. It's just a comic is a comic. Wherever you find your material, you find it.
So I wanted to ask you, there was this recent incident, a comedian named Sam Morrill, who, as it turns out, is Jewish, and he was heckled by someone shouting Free Palestine at him, even though his jokes, I mean, he just happens to be Jewish. Like, he doesn't even, as far as, from what I've seen, he doesn't tell Jewish jokes, and nor does he talk about Israel. And he sort of responded basically by making fun of the person in the audience. But have you ever had an incident like that where someone has said something against you for being Israeli or something anti-Semitic?
Not at a comedy club. Sam, first of all, Sam is a friend of mine and I love him and I love his comedy. He's hysterical and he has an amazing podcast with Mark Normand, and he's a great guy. And I love how you say he just happens to be Jewish. It's so funny. Well, mother Jewish?
No, but yes, there's like a...
No, but it's not part of his
like
routine.
There's people who tell Jewish Jewish jokes. 100%.
Listen, I recently got in trouble because on my podcast, I said that I'm one of the only like Jewish comedians. Like, I'm not just a comic who's Jewish. I'm a Jewish comedian. Like, right. My, you know, but so I understand what you said. I like the way you phrased that. But when I post something on my, on either on TikTok or on Instagram, I get a million different little free Palestine, stop oppressing Palestine. And they're sending it to me as if like I can go into the settings of my phone and go to general and, oh, here, Palestine free. Like it's, I have nothing to do with it. So I get that, but I've never had.
Halavai was just that easy, you know?
Halavai was just that easy. Yes. It's funny because I just was in Israel for 10 days and, whenever someone was saying Free Palestine, I wanted to write back Expensive Israel.
Yes.
Correct. You know, we were staying at the Kapinski and we were like, I was in shock at the bills we were getting. And it was, so every time I post something like, oh, look at me, I'm in the Judean Hills. Boom. Free Palestine. What are you doing there? Da, da, da. It's not your land. I'm like, okay.
So do you stay away from that though in your routines? I haven't, could be I missed it, but I haven't seen much talk about the kind of the political, it's complicated, right? The Israeli-Palestinian question.
It's very complicated, but, and that's not what I do. It's not what I, you know, it's, I stay away. It's not what I'm about. You know, I'll tell you, I have other friends that we discuss this, but like when, God forbid, when those attacks comes into Israel and the rockets are being launched and landing and hitting things and other comedians that which is their choice, they post pictures of it. They're showing you a rocket landing in a living room. They're on their page. My page is not for that. My page is for when you're watching CNN and you need to shut your mind off of it. Oh, let's go to Modi's page on Instagram, on his website, on his YouTube, and watch something and have fun. I'm not a political comedian. I don't focus on it. It's funny because I'm putting together my tweet for, you know, what's going on with Kanye West, right? I have a bit where I talk about, well, the Los Angeles Holocaust Museum sent out an invitation for him to come visit.
Like that's their thing.
That's it's their thing. But I always say it's the stupidest thing in the world. When you take somebody who hates Jews into a Holocaust museum, you just give them a hope and ideas is all you're giving them. You know, so I'm going to tweet that today on top of like the bit that I do. But otherwise, I never like harp on that and, but this has gone like a little too far where I can't ignore it. So you have to do something with the Kanye stuff.
Mm-hmm. Right. As a public figure who's Jewish, I get that.
Yeah.
So, Modi, your parents move from Israel to the United States. They take you to the five towns. They think their son is becoming an investment banker, and he goes and becomes a comedian. You have an Israeli mom. How does she take that?
It wasn't like I did my first night of comedy and then right away left banking and I'm going to go wait tables and do I was luckily I'm living in New York City. There were about five comedy clubs that were good. So at night I would work on my act. On the weekends I would be at clubs that hired me. And then, you know, the Catskill stuff was going on. All of a sudden, the Jewish market opened up to me, synagogues. And I was very lucky. It wasn't just comedy clubs. And I worked clean so I could do corporate events and special parties and things of that sort. So by the time I left the bank, I was already full-time making a living as a comedian. And it was only going to get better and better. And, you know, and she loved it. And no, it wasn't one of those things where the mother's screaming, don't leave banking and all that.
Mm-hmm. No disappointment.
No, not at all.
We're now in Sukkot.
Yes.
Have you ever had to explain Sukkot to a not Jewish audience? Because that sounds like a challenge.
Yes, I explain it to them in, you have to just be, again, quick. No one has an attention span. I say this reminds us of when we were traveling in the desert, and it's a holiday where we're immersed in a mitzvah, a good deed, where it's as though God is hugging us in the sukkah, and I explained that sukkah is like a hug from God, and then I leave it, and they're fine with it.
Mm-hmm. What was it that Cuomo called it? The stupid hut holiday or something? I have to find that quote. It was funny.
Who said that?
Governor Cuomo, after he resigned,
yeah.
Somebody found him here, the effing tree houses, he calls it.
That's funny.
So, yeah.
Well, Modi, it was great to have you on the Jerusalem Post podcast. We're all big fans. You got to come back to Israel and do another show. I think there's a lot more Israelis who would love to watch and hear you and see you.
Yeah, we sold that. So the truth of the matter was I went there. It was a last minute thing. I had a show in Sao Paulo, and then I went to Israel for a family bar mitzvah. And then we stayed there for another week. And Hatzalah, Eli Beer from Hatzalah, and I and the people that work with Hatzalah in Israel, we put together these two shows in Renana and in Tel Aviv, sold out right away. It was amazing. And it's funny because all the performers are in Israel now. I was the opposite. I went before the holidays.
Right. Elan Gold is performing over Sukkot here a few times.
Right. And all the singers are there. And Israel is amazing. I'm definitely going to be coming back there a lot more often. And yeah, it's I love performing in Israel. It's so special. It's so, so special.
Well, thanks for joining us. Have a Chag Sameach and Moedim L'Simcha. Thanks for being here.
Thank you.
Thanks, guys. Chag Sameach and a good Moed.
A good Moed.
To you too.
Bye.
We want to wish everyone a happy Sukkot. I hope that you are enjoying this week, which is supposed to be full of sort of happiness and fun. And we will see you again next week. If you enjoyed the podcast, don't forget, recommend it to your friends and family and give us a high rating on Apple Podcasts.